Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
Rex, do you believe in evil? As an idea, do you believe in the power of darkness? As a superstition. Now there you are wrong. The power of darkness is more than just a superstition. It is a living force which can be tapped at any given moment of the night.
Your will is leaving you, slipping away.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Nine shot dead by far-right extremist in Hanau, Germany, who then shoots his mother and himself dead. Just as a new UK ambassador to Germany, Richard Greenwell, that's also the director of National Intelligence, arrives in Berlin. And if you've not heard from this show's favourite Democratic nomination candidate, Tulsi Gabbard, that's just what the oligarchy wanted, you'll be hearing from her tonight. Have you got £4.6 million to start a political party? The Thai opposition party Future Forward founder did. He's forced to close it today amid claims it's part of a famous Western elite cult, the Illuminati. As a real treat, before I take a few weeks off, a rogue insider reminds us all how terrible our mass media are with 10 minutes of straight talking on the finance of politics, which I think you'll agree is worth a year of the financial media's mendacious babble. And what is the UK exporting to the US? Well, Oxitec is high tech, but is it ethical? Extracts from two documentaries tonight. The first about AIDS, that is the first so-called virus ever found to target the T cells of our immune system. From 2011, the documentary's AIDS, the greatest medical fraud in history. Then up to 2019 with the winner of the Sundance Film Festival's Best Documentary Award, Cold Case Hammarskjöld, exposing the secret far-right private army, Saimar, who assassinated the UN Secretary-General in 1961, Dag Hammarskjöld. Then, this little private army went on to inject black people, apparently, in Mozambique with AIDS, and murder the young biologist Dagmar Fayle, who tried to expose Saimar to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, Tuesday at noon. This week, the producer of the best documentary at Sundance 2019, that's Andreas Roxton. And two young people in Bristol try and answer the question, mobile phones, blessing or curse? You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. So, but we'll start this week, Martin, with this attack in Germany of two bars where basically it's a far-right attack. I mean, the idea, I suppose, is Germany's a particularly worrying place where we see the far-right gaining ground.
Yeah, well, the information I've seen so far suggests that he acted alone, which is worrying.
That's what they always say.
That's what they always say. And, of course, there's other people who've been arrested last week who definitely weren't acting alone. They were definitely a cell of people who had contacts inside the security forces. And if you remember a couple of years ago now, there was a guy in Austria who was arrested who definitely had links with the security forces. And they were planning to carry out an attack to be blamed upon Muslims in order to try and tighten laws against in order to create a strategy of tension, basically. And this is the big worry, is once you've got a strategy of tension rolling, for example, when you carry out the 9/11 attack, and it's basically done from inside the structure, you've then created a possibility of lone wolf people doing stuff, and therefore you're basically giving power to the security state as going forward, and that's clearly where we've ended up.
Now, what we've seen is this guy in Hanau is we've seen the mass media churning out his kind of propaganda stuff that he was doing, which I find rather distasteful. So he's done a little video. They decide to put it on TV so we can see who he is, what he's saying, and all that kind of thing. Now, of course, we want to have a free press, but I rather prefer the attitude that they had in New Zealand, which is where the New Zealand leaders were saying, well, we don't actually want to even name this guy. Let's not give him the publicity he was seeking.
Well, I think, as you say, there's two sides to this. You don't want to give these people unnecessary publicity. On the other hand, we really need to know what's happened in any particular event. So, for example, in New Zealand, I saw and you saw the video that he took when he was carrying the shootings out. And, of course, that helps us to try and understand whether this is actually a single event or whether it's related to a pattern of events. So we found out, for example, by investigation that there was some kind of exercise of something similar happening on the day, and then people turned up to shoot him dead. The same with things with attacks in London, isn't it?
Strange? Also, we heard
right on the as soon as this happens, the police just happened to be there with the SWAT team.
With the New Zealand guy, it was supposedly he was a lone wolf, but then we've seen that actually he'd been being tracked by the intelligence agencies all over the place. And he himself, this guy in Germany, said that the intelligence agencies have been tracking him for years.
Yes, well, so in other words, the question is now, and has to be, is this a genuinely independent attack, or is it related, A, to bigger organisations like Islamic State, or B, more importantly, is Islamic State and Al-Qaeda being run by the intelligence service? And, of course, the answer to that is yes. Everybody in the Syrian army is very well aware of that. I've been reading this afternoon about British military intelligence paying, using our taxes, at least about £500,000 a month to provide PR to Al-Qaeda in Syria.
And the other thing about the Hanau attacker is, of course, he ends up dead, as well as his mother, so there will be no trial.
Well, that's right. And that's what there's a pattern involved in this going back years. And, of course, the Gladio networks operating in Western Europe still exist. And, of course, they carried out all of the attacks in Italy in the 1970s and 80s, according to Italian police investigation. So people just shouldn't presume that they know what's happened when these events take place. There's a whole program behind all of this, which is essentially to militarize democratic societies and prevent social change from taking place.
Well, I mean,
place.
It's also something that they call hardening the sides, isn't it, in military language, which is getting people to choose either one side or another side of a sort of street battle that's going on.
Yeah.
One side is the side of radical Islam, and the other side is the far right.
Well, indeed, and this fits exactly into the strategia di tensione, which was carried out in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't random people doing random stuff. There are. But there are also organisations which are pushing this. And when people say, well, Islamic State was behind this woman that's just gone trial in the Old Bailey this week, well, I will say, well, who's the Islamic State? And as I say, the Syrian Arab Army and the Russian General Staff are quite clear who the Islamic State is. It's a front organisation for Western intelligence organisations, as it has been since the 1980s.
Well, there's lots of unanswered questions about the Bataclan attacks in 2015, for example.
Yep.
Very bizarre footage and also questions about ownership of the places. This, though, is a single person doing this attack this time. We're pretty sure about that.
Well, I mean, we shouldn't jump to any sharp conclusions until all the evidence is in. It may well be that this is just a random person, but one of the things he was saying, he said himself that he was being mind-controlled by an intelligence service. That's what he said.
Oh, a Manchurian candidate type.
Well, indeed. MKUltra, people can look this up. The US military have been researching for years to try and mind control people, and the odds are that they've succeeded. And, of course, a lot of the people who carry out these attacks are, there's a general analysis. You've got the patsies, the moles, and the technicians. The patsies are the people who end up doing the attack, supposedly. They end up dead, usually. You've got the moles, who are the real perpetrators, usually senior people in the intelligence services, and you've got the technicians who actually carry out the attack, like where a bomb has to be made. Somebody has to know how to make bombs. So, and of course, the attack on Manchester, the brother of the bomber is on trial at the moment, and of course, all of that family were part of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which has got links going to with MI6 and MI5 going back decades.
The Manchester attack's a good one case in point, isn't it? Because it seems as if anybody that actually knew the individual involved is also being sucked in, and there's an attempt to say that they're a terrorist too. And also, in that attack, it was quite clear that people had been warning the authorities, MI5 specifically, about on the terrorist hotline, about this specific individual that is supposed to have carried out the attack. Finally, when we were shown the evidence that he was there on the day, there is no evidence at all, because you've just got a CCTV of the attacker and everything around him is blacked out. It's just a silhouette, really.
Well, indeed, and the father of the brothers made a statement in Tripoli, because he'd been flown back to Libya to fight for the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group against Gaddafi with British support. That's why the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is based in Manchester, because since the 1980s they've been working with MI6 and MI5. And at the very least you could say is that's blowback. If you insist on working with Islamic extremists like that, and of course many Libyans went through the hands of the British Intelligence Services and Security Forces to go and fight in Afghanistan in the 80s, so this goes back to that era. And that you could say, well, there's blowback involved in this. If you play with fire, you're going to get burned. But it's probably worse than that. They're actually engaged in provoking and orchestrating these attacks. The 9/11 attacks, as Donald Trump pointed out on the day, those buildings don't collapse like that. They must have been bombed.
So what's the bigger picture?
What's the bigger picture here?
You've got the far right on the ground. You've got Islamists, usually abroad, but sometimes on the ground here in the West, apparently doing terrorist attacks in some way targeted each other, but in a kind of a random way. In other words, so it might be ordinary white people attacked, or in fact random people any old colour, or it could be, say, in this bar, just completely random Asian people. They don't even necessarily know, you know, whether they have a particular faith or not. So what you're ending up with here is the sort of thing that was going on in Northern Ireland, but when there were completely indiscriminatory attacks. In other words, what was called in those days a sectarian attack, just on a whole sector of society rather than on specific individuals as part of a war.
Well, Vincenzo Vincinguero, who was a mole in the Gladio networks in Italy, and people can see his interview in Frankovich's films, which are on BBC, about Gladio. People can just look them up.
That was the Time Watch series.
Time Watch series. He said, well, the whole point of us attacking people at random is we're trying to terrify the population so that they will then agree with extreme measures to be taken to protect them, which means, of course, that the secret state then gets more and more power. And the secret state, of course, is behind the attacks and then says, oh, we need more resources to deal with these terrible attacks.
So you mentioned Gladio there. In what way could this attack be related to these, what we know full well now, were Operation Gladio attacks in the 1970s, 1980s, which were orchestrated by the NATO intelligence services in many countries around Europe, particularly Italy. That's actually been documented now, that random people were killed in the street by NATO intelligence operatives. But in what way? And that, of course, was the idea, was to blame it at the time on the Soviet Union. And that, though, that's where the blame was directed. But this is somewhere else. You know, this is a completely new thing.
Well, I mean, look at it this way. The Germans would quite like to build a pipeline, a finishing building, a pipeline from Russia, which brings natural gas from Russia to Germany. The Americans don't like that, so they can make trouble for Germany. And the same thing happened with the Brabant massacres in Belgium in the 1980s, where the Belgian parliament are basically moving towards voting against having cruise missiles in Belgium.
Which I think,
and then suddenly all these random attacks in supermarkets with people wearing funny masks take place. And of course the police investigation ultimately showed this comes from the security services. Don't presume that your own security services are working for the government of the day.
Okay, haven't the Belgians recently also been trying to get rid of American nuclear forces? Because they're saying that this just makes us a target.
Well, indeed. But of course what happens when that happens is a bit like the mafia. They say, look, you people, accidents can happen. You need a bit of protection. Yeah?
Now, the Gladio units of NATO originally actually go back to the Nazis, don't they? With the old werewolf operatives from the Nazi days, you know, just before the end of the Second World War.
That's right. The werewolves became the gladiators. And of course what happened was that the fascist intelligence structures were not dismantled by NATO, they were basically incorporated. And the idea behind it, when insofar as investigations, and of course there have been parliamentary investigations in Italy and Belgium and in Switzerland into all of this, and they've even admitted that that's what went on, although they don't say what's going on now, The idea was that if the Soviet Union invaded, these people would be the kind of resistance. But of course, the Soviet Union had no intention of invading. They were too busy trying to rebuild their own part of the planet. And of course, they were then used to undermine progressive political forces in Western Europe through brutal terrorism, the killing of innocent people. 87 people were killed at Bologna Railway Station, for example.
Here in the UK, Harold Wilson was said to be a Russian spy, wasn't he?
He was, and of course that then gave MI5 and MI6 the excuse to do everything they could to undermine him. Basically, what he'd done wrong was refuse to send the British Army to fight in Vietnam, and that marked his card.
What do you make, then, this week, of the new US ambassador for Germany, Richard Greenwell, taking up his post? Because he's the first US ambassador abroad to also be taking on a dual role. He's also the US's director of national intelligence at the same time as being the German ambassador.
Well, that's rather extraordinary, isn't it? But I mean, basically, US ambassadors can be just about anybody. They're political appointees. They're not necessarily got any expertise whatsoever. The previous German ambassador completely alienated the German political class because he basically used to wag his finger and lecture them all
the
time.
But I mean, isn't it bizarre to have the US Director of National Intelligence based in Berlin?
Well, it's because there's a Cold War going on between the Western deep state and the Russians, and Germany's a key battleground. So they've got to make sure that Germany doesn't take the wrong decisions.
Is there cooperation between Germany? This is the idea, is it? Surely the Director of National Intelligence for the United States needs to be in the United States, not in Germany.
Well, I mean, I don't know the full details about this guy, but we know what's going on in a broader pattern, which is that the US and their great Rottweilers, the British, are determined to prevent the Germans pursuing an independent policy vis-a-vis the Russians. It's as clear as that. And by any means necessary, including terrorism. People say, well, they don't do terrorism. I just laugh. It's ridiculous. The evidence is overwhelming that they've been behind a lot of this terrorism going on for years, including the most extreme Islamist terrorism. Everybody knows that the biggest supporters of Islamist extremism in this country are the Saudi government. The Saudi government that is in cahoots with our Tory government, which buys loads of our weaponry, which sends all their boys to Sandhurst.
Anyway, those guys. Just as we are becoming the unsinkable aircraft carrier and part of the American empire rather than the Brussels empire, I think we really got to keep quite a close eye on what's happening with the Democratic nominations, Martin. I mean, do you think I'm being a bit obsessive with the to see who's actually going to be running against Trump?
What's coming out, of course, is this stuff that's come out recently about how Trump supposedly said to Assange, if he was able to say that the Russians didn't hack the WikiLeaks emails about the Democratic primaries last time, then he could get a pardon. And that's, you know, that's several levels of stupidity away from what people really need to be thinking about. The fact of the matter is that if you're going to have a primary system like you do in the US, I mean, it's very, very bizarre. It's a bit like the Cuban Communist Party or the Chinese Communist Party. You can only vote for people that we vetted first. So in many ways, if you rig that, then you've rigged the whole election. And of course, Seth Rich looks as if he was murdered because he knew too much about the rigging of the Democratic nomination last time to keep out Sanders. And of course, Tulsi Gabbard has never been able to get any traction on the setup. I think what she's doing is she's running to just try and show what could be possible if people recognised the level of manipulation that's going on.
Yeah, she's opened up all guns on the actual Democratic National Committee itself and its chairman. So is there any reason? I mean, she's actually attacking her own party rather than the Republicans.
Yeah, but when you say your own party, what you're talking about in the US system, you've got to be officially of one party or another if you want to get anywhere. You can be in part of other parties, but you've got no chance of getting elected. And the whole system is run as if it were an official system. And therefore, you can choose to be a Republican or a Democrat or an Independent. But in actual fact, of course, in Russia, you can be a Communist or a Nationalist or a Liberal.
One of the reasons we haven't heard from Tulsi Gabbard is because she's really exposing the system of fake nominations in the United States and the way it's rigged. So here she is speaking on Fox News this week.
What is your case against Tom Perez, starting with Iowa, as we see these new reports suggesting maybe the DNC was more deeply involved in that app that caused the chaos?
Tom Perez is the chairman of the DNC.
It comes down to a failure of leadership, and there are numerous examples of this failure of leadership that has shaken the trust and faith that voters in this primary election should have, that when they go and cast their votes, their voices will be heard. Mm-hmm. There has been an incredible lack of transparency around the failures of the Iowa caucuses, the app that was such a terrible failure, and the DNC's involvement in this. You had a former Iowa Democratic Party chair saying the Iowa Democratic Party should sue the DNC for making them use this app that had been completely untested, and that if you look at who was involved with this app, you have Hillary Clinton's former campaign manager, Robbie Mook. You have people who are very deeply entrenched in the powerful elite in Washington mm-hmm. who are backing this app. What's really going on here? You mentioned the DNC changing the rules to let the billionaire yeah. Michael Bloomberg onto the debate stage, picking and choosing who they want voters to hear from, rather than letting voters get the information they need to make that best informed decision when they go to the ballot box.
Here's what Tom Perez said, in fairness to him, when pressed on whether he should step down.
Have you considered resigning?
Absolutely not. Look at the last 3 years. My job when I came in was to rebuild our infrastructure, to win elections, and when you do that, sometimes you got to make tough decisions. We have been winning. This is what it's about. I think it's really important for people to take a broader step back right now.
He clearly seems to be hanging it on the wins back in the midterms, looking in the rearview mirror. What is your concern moving forward?
Look, Tom Perez, in his own words, said, you know, leading up to the Iowa caucuses, we have been working towards this day for 3 years, expressing his confidence that we were ready. Well, clearly that wasn't the case. This is bigger. This includes other issues that really speak to a disrespect to voters, Democratic voters across this country, who deserve more than a DNC and their corporate mm-hmm. media partners holding their own pre-primary selection process, making it very difficult or impossible for voters to hear from candidates that they don't want them to hear from.
That's Tulsi Gabbard there, and she's one of those that the corporate media pals of the Democratic National Convention don't want people to hear from those candidates. It's an incredible system, isn't it, really?
Well, it is, and it's actually evolved basically in the 1960s, because previously, of course, basically the Republican Party and the Democratic Party used to fix it up behind closed doors. And there's no rule that says a political party has to have Democratic primaries. But, of course, when you have them, they ought to be above reproach. But, of course, they're not above reproach, and it's a mechanism okay. for controlling who can possibly win.
Got a special treat for you here, Martin, one of your favourite economists. Who might that be, do you think? Would you like to guess?
I don't know. You'll have to tell.
American guy?
Michael Hudson.
Well, here he is talking about the US election process.
The Democrats are talking about every kind of hyphenated American there is, from sexual hyphenations to ethnic hyphenations. There's only one kind of identity that they don't talk about. That's wage earners and consumers. That's the identity that you have in common, of debtors, of people who you're all being exploited by. You're part of an exploitative system, of a financial system, a real estate system, a tax system. And the problem is that both parties have the same donors. And, they've decided, I guess about a few months ago, we know who the candidate's going to be and win the next election. Both parties have chosen the same candidate, Donald Trump. The Democrats' problem is how do we get a candidate so bad that he's guaranteed to lose to Donald Trump, so that who's doing all of our wonderful policies? He's cutting the taxes on us. He's doing everything, and we get to blame them and say it's not us, it's the Republicans. I mean, who can they get that's really bad? Amy Klobuchar or Buttigieg?
Yeah, that's a pretty savvy analysis of the way it's working. Bloomberg, who's trying to bully his way into the nomination, he used to be the Republican mayor of New York, and he's a billionaire. It's like as if some billionaire, Richard Branson, decided he wanted to run the Labour Party.
Yeah, there he is in the TV debates, a Republican, yet Tulsi Gabbard's not there.
Well, he's not a Republican anymore because he's switched to being a Democrat, because he can do that, you see. And Tulsi Gabbard, of course, who's an ex-military, relatively younger woman who's got a radical message, well, they don't want to hear that.
Anyway, the financial oligarchy really run things. We all know that. They buy the politicians, buy the political parties. And I thought it'd be good to hear this week from Michael Hudson a bit of an analysis of how that all that works, particularly because we don't really hear hardly any of this sort of, in fact, I've never seen on our mass media in the UK any analysis by Michael.
People are not making money by hiring labor anymore. They're making money by buying stocks and bonds and having the government artificially support their prices until finally they say it's all over, sell out, there will be a huge crash, the pension funds will all crash, and they're going to leave, they call the weak holders, the pension funds and the non 10%, holding the bag, as it were. So if the economy is shrinking, then obviously the flow of profits, the output is going to be shrinking, unless companies can simply sell less goods, but for much more. And so the Trump administration has followed the Democrats in getting rid of the anti-monopoly legislation and prosecution. They're essentially promoting just rising prices for everything. So the question is, how long can companies get by producing less, charging more, when the customers are poor and poor? And you're not selling to China anymore, or Russia, or even Europe, because they can't trust American suppliers, or they don't want to buy more Boeings. Trump has wanted them to buy at least a military industrial goods, but they're pushing back on that. So obviously there are a lot of corporations that are going to go the way of Toys R Us, Sears, Roebuck. You see, the retail stores are the first that are going bankrupt. Then you're going to have the heavily leveraged buildings where either the building goes bankrupt or you borrow from the Saudi Arabians, like Trump's family have done. So the housing bubble was very largely fraud, to answer your question, but the corporate bubble is just plain greed, and finance lives in the short term. They all know that the debts can't be paid. Everybody I talk to on Wall Street knows that there's going to be a crash, but they think they can sell out first because someone from the government and the Fed will call them and say, we're going to raise interest rates suddenly, bail out, and they're all going to bail out and leave the non-insiders holding the bag, or at least they think that they can do that. But this isn't talked about in the press because bad economic news doesn't attract advertisers to the newspapers. And newspapers, their clients are the advertisers, not really the readers. So the newspapers are going to say, yes, the economy's growing, everything's doing fine. And politically, the media worry that if they say, well, we're in an economy that's shrinking and living standards are going to fall, then Wall Street's siphoning off the money, then people are going to turn socialist. Well, obviously, you're not going to have the government economists creating a body of socialists by telling them how the economy really works and what's in store for them all. So that's the problem, cognitive dissonance.
Well, Hudson is quite an old guy now, but he's a professor and he's been around for quite a long time. And, of course, his analysis is absolutely correct. I mean, we've basically got an oligarchy run society, which uses various tricks, including manipulation of the property market, government spending on the military, secret services, and links into organized crime to keep the population down.
Well, what about what he was saying at the start there, which is actually hiring people and using them to make stuff or do stuff? I'm afraid that's going out of fashion.
Well, what happened, there was a period from 1945 to 1973, not least because of the competition provided by, you know, competition could be a good thing, provided by the Soviet Union and the Chinese, that we're going to have to do something to look after the ordinary folks in the West, otherwise they're going to rebel. And so, you know, that was the period when I was growing up, when basically living standards rose year on year, productivity rose year on year, but wages rose with productivity. So as people's productivity improved, they got more money to spend and goods were, you know, and it basically, it worked, and of course, it worked to a point where the ruling class began to think, hang on, this is working too well. And of course, once the Soviet Union collapsed, they said, well, we don't have to do that anymore. Let's go back to running it the way we did in the 19th century. We just stitch everything up, and that's what they've done.
Well, one of the things that Britain is supposed to do now is all this high-tech, amazing kind of super high-tech technology, which we're exporting to places like the United States. And I heard this report on the BBC World Service a few weeks ago, which really raised my eyebrows, about a British company called Oxitec.
In the past, farmers have sprayed their crops with pesticides, but the chemicals are damaging the environment, and the more they are used, the more insects build up a resistance to them. One of those insects is the diamondback moth, which is a major pest across the planet, causing an estimated $5 billion a year of damage to crops such as cabbage, broccoli and oilseed rape. But Oxitec has found a way of genetically modifying the male diamondback moth in a laboratory, then releasing it into the wild and in effect killing off the females. Dr. Neil Morrison is the lead agricultural scientist at Oxitec.
So our moth carries two genes, one of which is a self-limiting gene. So after we release our moths onto a given field, it mates with wild pest diamondback moths, and its female offspring can't survive. So if we keep releasing our male moths into that field, the number of females in the next generation declines, and so the pest population is controlled.
Working with Cornell University, the company carried out field trials in New York State, where they released between 1,000 and 2,500 male diamondbacks on six separate occasions. As expected, the moths did not persist in the wild. The company hopes to sell these modified insects to American farmers. It's also carried out field trials of genetically modified mosquitoes in Brazil, the Cayman Islands, Panama, and Malaysia.
So Oxitec, spelled O-X-I-T-E-C-H, but apparently they can only try this out in the United States, Martin.
Well, I mean, the potential of this technology is interesting, but of course I don't trust these people to carry it out, because their motivation's all wrong. If ultimately I would see running these things as public utilities, for example, as a way of avoiding the profit taking, which means that they cut corners. And of course they're also working with governments, because they've got to try and destroy other people's capacities. So the US farm sector, for example, the guy who was in charge of it in the 1960s said, well, we've got to destroy everybody else's farming systems, and that way we will control the planet. I can't remember the name. I quoted him.
They've made some genetic modifications to this moth. So when they send the moth out there, every moth it breeds with, this is a Terminator technology.
It is, and of course we've always been modifying nature, so in a sense there's no real difference between doing that and doing things that we've always done, but I don't trust these people to do it. Don't forget that in actual fact farming in the US is massively subsidised, and it's massively subsidised for a reason. It's in order to destroy the capacity of non-US farming systems to be resilient, because they want people eating American food. The USAID provides about 50% of Bangladesh's calorific intake, for example, and that means when it comes to, say, a war on Iraq, you turn around to the Bangladeshi government, who might not be keen on it at all, and say, do you want us to cut off your food supply? Of course you don't.
Well, the other thing, of course, is it makes it impossible for any organic farmers to be organic anymore if they've got genetically modified moths flying around.
That's the whole point. And you know, the common agricultural policy was only developed in Western Europe in the 1950s and 60s, in that period when the full-on, no-holds-barred capitalism was under some kind of control. Because otherwise, we'd all be just eating subsidised American stuff. And that's their policy. It's always been their policy.
So today, a Thai opposition party that pushed for democratic reform has just been disbanded. The Future Forward Party narrowly avoided dissolution back in January when the Constitutional Court found the party not guilty in a case that alleged it had attempted to overthrow the monarchy, which is the power broker in Thailand's government, accused it of having links to a cult called the Illuminati, a secret society that conspiracy theorists say seeks world domination. The party's quick success may have led to its downfall. Although Thailand held a general election in 2019, the military general who seized control back in 2014, military coup, was installed as prime minister under electoral rules created under the junta's rule. The military-led government, which is backed by the monarchy, has disbanded several pro-democracy parties in the last 2 decades. So many millions, I think it was 3.5 million, this guy just started up a party very recently, and they're fighting the elections, and they're told, well, you can't do that. You can't just use a gift of £3.5 million to start a political party. You do wonder, don't you, if what is going on here? There's two very different approaches. Surely people can start up a party if they want, but remember what happened with Emmanuel Macron in France, where suddenly a massive amount of money descended on this new party. Macron wins the election, and now you've got all the turmoil we've seen in France. It turns out he's just an operator for the international financial elite.
Well, in Norway, nobody is allowed to, anybody can form a political party, but the only money you're allowed to spend on elections depends upon the vote you got in the last election. Now, in Thailand, you've got a swing state. Basically, they're trying to pursue a policy of being in the middle between China and the West. And the red shirts in Thailand, the Shinawatra family, who are the leaders of that, they've got massive support from the West to try and destabilise the traditional setup inside Thailand. Now, of course, the Thai army have resisted this because they basically are trying to pursue a policy which is more pro-Chinese than the West would like. And, of course, that means that people come in and try and interfere with your politics.
Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, in the dock in March the 17th. That's in, 3 and a bit weeks' time. What's going to happen if he's convicted of bribery and fraud?
Well, he may find a way to just skip out of it. And if Benny Gantz wins the election, you've still got just an equally nasty person running it.
So nothing's going to change?
Well, nothing's going to change for the Palestinians in this circumstance.
Okay,
no.
Also big, nasty fight potentially brewing up in northwest Syria with Putin and Erdogan. Because the Turks are in there with their army, but actually they're refusing to go. They're actually keeping the terrorists in Idlib supplied. So that's going to be a real tough fight for the Syrian army to get the terrorists out, where they're being backed by the Turks.
Well, this week, I understand, the Turks have artillery there, and they were using their artillery to knock out Syrian tanks and armoured vehicles. And
artillery against tanks.
Yes, because that's what else are you going to shoot a tank with? You're not going to shoot it with a rifle, are you? But what happened was the artillery positions of the Turkish military were attacked.
But the artillery is used generally anti-personnel it's indirect fire, isn't it? It comes down from above. Well, you can't aim it at a tank.
Listen, I'm just telling you what I've read this week,
okay,
Tony.
All right.
The most important political aspect of this is that the Russian Air Force bombed the Turkish military and killed some of their people. Don't forget, because they've also taken casualties from the Turks. So the Turks and the Russian military are already exchanging fire, which is easily.
So the Russians are fighting NATO this week.
That's right. That's right.
Where's it going?
Well, if people aren't careful, it's going to go into a full-on fight. I don't think the Turks are going to get much support from the rest of NATO. And the Russians have been pointing out to them that NATO has been supplying the Kurds, who are their great enemies, with great big chunks of weaponry. And the Russians are trying to persuade the Turks to leave Syria. And the Turks are saying, Erdogan today did a tweet where he said, well, large chunks of Syria used to be part of Turkey, and therefore we're claiming them effectively, which of course is basically changing people's borders, which is like, well, you're really going to fight to change this border. And of course they haven't got air superiority, and the Russians can attack them. They flew a couple of their planes across the Black Sea to show that we can attack you from any angle. And don't forget, they've got these hypersonic missiles now, which can fire from inside Russia, from Siberia, and they can hit with pinpoint accuracy stuff in Idlib province.
2000, that's Laika with Moccasin, taking us into a look at a couple of documentaries. So that song about relationships, quite appropriate for some of the stuff we've been hearing, but also appropriate because it's Laika Films, the Laika Films are the people that actually made the Cold Case Homicide documentary, which we'll be hearing some extracts from in a minute, though. But before that, we're going to have a look at AIDS and this old documentary. It's, well, I say old, from 2011, the AIDS, the Greatest Medical Fraud in History. Before we hear an extract from that, Martin, what do you make of AIDS? Because there's been a lot of conspiracy theories about that over the years. Can you see the wood for the trees?
Well, I'm not an expert in any of these things, so I tend to withhold judgment. The things I know about, and I'm prepared to put my, to take a stand on, are things like international terrorism, bomb attacks, shootings, the drugs trade. That's all pretty clear what's going on. Gladio, if anybody needs, we mentioned it before, but people really need to look at that. Gladio, there's plenty of stuff out there. That's how the intelligence services behave. They are drug dealers and murderers. Well, so would they do things with AIDS as well? The question is, did they? Not would they, but they definitely would.
So we'll start off with a clip from the documentary, which is about whether or not you can actually rely on the AIDS test itself.
The proteins used on that Western blot strip that scientists claim are HIV proteins may not necessarily be HIV proteins. There's no proof that they are, and there's plenty of evidence that these are normal human cellular proteins that have been misidentified. This conclusion seems hardly debatable in the case of P32, one of these purportedly HIV proteins that's been shown to be identical in amino acid sequence to a normal human protein associated with human T cell function. Another one of these proteins, P41, has been considered by Montagnier's group, Montagnier, the original discoverer of HIV, to be a contaminant, the ubiquitous cellular protein actin. Yet it's right there on your Western blot test, masquerading as an HIV protein.
There seems to be a double standard as far as the doctors are concerned. They'll use many of these drugs that haven't been proven on human beings, and they use them on AIDS patients. But these very same doctors will not use herbs, and they will not use vitamins, and they will not use minerals, because I don't know. Could I say that the bottom line could be the profit motive?
I am suspect about everything involved in this AIDS epidemic, because it seems only, if HIV causes anything, boy, if it causes anything, it certainly causes fundraisers, and it raises funds in many different ways. It sells stocks, it supports dances, it has all sorts of, sells condoms, and keeps the AIDS establishment going. I mean, the doctors are treated very well by the pharmaceutical companies. They're wined and dined at the meetings. The meetings are incredible trade shows. People playing with condoms, pulling them over their heads, blowing condoms up, seeing how much air they could hold. All of this stuff goes on. And there wasn't even a lounge for people with AIDS. There were, at some of the conferences that I've gone to, they put a lounge for people with AIDS at the farthest building from the conference, on the fourth floor, without a couch, without even any water in the room. And they had to be reminded, the conference governors had to be reminded that perhaps you could put some water and some fruit, maybe, and maybe a couch. And their ACT-UP had to carry the couch into the room, and then they put guards at the door.
The problem was at this time already that in medicine people would not look to the facts, but what is possible to sell on the market, because it was the year 1977 when it became possible to patent medical techniques. So they wouldn't care if there's any a clinical meaning behind those measurements, but they just sold it on the market. And the model of immunology would say at this time, if the immune system is weak, so cancer would appear. And that has been fundamentally mistaken, and it was wrong when they said it in 81. They knew it already in 1980 that this has been wrong. The immune surveillance theory of cancer came into existence when the war against cancer failed.
About 1970, major cancer research laboratories were passionately involved in attempts to demonstrate that retroviruses were associated with human cancer. They really didn't get very far, not far at all. And somehow, around 1980, 81, when the first cases of AIDS were reported, this came to these groups as at least one way out of the mostly negative result they had obtained for about 10 years before. So the AIDS research, I regard it as an extension of an earlier effort to demonstrate retrovirus in human cancer.
They were working with the test, with cells in the test tube, and say, look, we have a high activity of reverse transcription, therefore a virus must be inside, and the virus is the cause of cancer. But the nature of cancer is much different, and when they found reverse transcription everywhere, they gave up the idea that retroviruses would cause cancer. And they were not speaking about it anymore, but wasted billions of dollars into this and developed chemotherapy based on this idea that the multiplication of genetic material, and they were thinking of the viruses, should be blocked. So they developed molecules which were incorporated in a growing chain of newly to build up genetic material, and which would kill the build up or prevent the build up of this genetic molecule, and the cell eventually has to die. The idea of retroviruses in cancer is long over, but the chemotherapy still is there because it's sold, and they have no idea why, no rational explanation why they are using chemotherapy.
I mean, I thought a lot of it is that it's such complicated science, this particularly virology, Martin, that it's very difficult for anyone to get their heads around it.
It is, but we know that the Pentagon has been funding biological warfare research for years and years and years, and one presumes they've been funding it because they intend to use it. Now, whether they have used it or not, we don't know. We certainly know that Agent Orange, for example, was sprayed all over Vietnam and caused thousands of birth defects, millions of people affected. And they didn't care about that. I sent you a thing the other week about what the biological and chemical warfare that they used to use in Korea, because they basically tried to wipe out the North Korean population using biological and chemical agents. I think the evidence is overwhelming that they did that. Now, if you think that they're capable of doing that in the 1950s, and you think, well, they haven't got any better, then the possibility of them doing these things deliberately is definitely there. But, of course, you've got to prove it.
Based upon my 25 years of research and massive interviewing more than 3,000 physicians, scientists, experts, and activists on the subject of AIDS and AIDS-related illnesses, particularly how it was affecting Africans, there appears to be only one startling conclusion that I can reasonably come to, and that is, AIDS is not about a virus. No, it is about the untreated underlying diseases such as malaria, tuberculosis, malnutrition, and waterborne illnesses including diarrhea and parasitic infections. It is about living in dire poverty and conditions of chronic civil war. It is about suffering the lethal effects of the AIDS diagnosis itself, including the harmful drugs that are prescribed in clinic after clinic where AIDS individuals are provided, however, with good nutrition and clean water and proper medications for underlying illnesses such as malaria. The vast majority of individuals return to proper health. But when AIDS individuals are severely compromised in their immune systems and are given the most lethal medications ever created, they do get sicker and they die. But their deaths and illnesses are then blamed on the HIV virus instead of the real illnesses underlying their AIDS conditions. More and more experts are agreeing on this view of AIDS. And yet, this view has been suppressed as contrary to the financial interests of the AIDS establishment and its drug manufacturers. Isn't it time that we take a closer, unbiased look at AIDS in Africa and its real causes and real solutions?
Okay, so the documentary is called The Greatest Medical Fraud in History, The Pain, Profit and Politics of AIDS. And there's scores of doctors there, Martin, who are just exasperated by the bad science that is put out by some of the people who are talking, effectively trying to push this as a AZT, for example, was a drug which was put as an AIDS treatment, but which was actually killing people. That's what the documentary says.
There's a number of things you need to unpack here. It's possible that the AIDS virus was deliberately created as a biological warfare agent.
Well, one of the reasons, of course, we're bringing this up is because there apparently have been parts of the AIDS virus found in this coronavirus by New Delhi Virology Institute.
Well, that's what studies in India seem to have shown in the last week or so. The fact is that it's not just, I mean, what I heard there, and of course it's only a short extract, is that the real problems they have is malnutrition and illness and so on. The HIV is secondary. That's what Thabo Mbeki said in South Africa. And lots of people said that's just wrong. Clearly, I would suggest that the AIDS virus does exist. The question is, where did it come from?
Okay, we're going to hear from South Africa now, from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in our first clip from the documentary called Case Hammarskjöld.
In August 1998, having spent more than 4 years investigating the crimes of the apartheid regime, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was closing down. To mark the end of their work, they held a final press conference in Cape Town, chaired by Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
It is a very special moment for all of us. We have discovered in the course of our investigations, documents purporting to be from an institution called the South African Institute of Maritime Research, discussing the sabotage of the aircraft in which the United Nations Secretary General Doug Hammarskjöld died on the night of September 17, 1861.
Has everybody got a copy of this set of documents?
Institute for Maritime Research.
How many are missing? Sorry, just indicate.
The documents comes from, allegedly from a shadowy private paramilitary intelligence organization known as the South African Maritime Research Institute. And they are the manuscript for killing Dag Hammarskjöld.
The full set of documents discovered in the vaults of South Africa's Secret Service was said to consist of 12 pages, but the originals have since vanished in South African state archives. What remains are blurred photocopies of 9 pages, outlining a plot to kill Dag Hammarskjöld with a bomb. The documents say that Hammarskjöld had to be removed because the United Nations had become troublesome. Among the conspirators, British intelligence is mentioned, as well as the American Intelligence Service, the CIA.
Do you know whether the institute still exists?
Yes, in fact, when we got this document, which was about a few months ago, the first thing that we did was to send an investigator to establish whether, in fact, there is an institute of this nature. We are of the view that there is an institute, though in a different form or a slightly different form.
But none of the journalists went to look for the institute themselves. Maybe because the British Foreign Office, as well as the CIA, quickly scrambled to bury the story as a piece of Cold War misinformation planted by the Russians. As a result, the South African Institute for Maritime Research, or in short SIMAR, remains mostly uncharted territory.
It is not impossible that the account carried by these documents is genuine, but it is just as possible that they are a well-informed fabrication.
What little we know about SIMAR today is thanks to the South African journalist David Potgieter. Back in the early 90s, he met with a man who claimed to be the Commodore of SIMAR, a man named Keith Maxwell.
He described himself as commander of the SIMAR's military unit, Delta. And he said that the unit is the successor of an 184-year-old organization first formed by a group of British mariners. Preferring to remain anonymous, the group's interests are diverse. Some orders come from London and others are initiated here in South Africa.
So there you have it, Martin. It's actually released by Desmond Tutu himself, this information, but it wasn't really picked up at all in the West by journalists.
No, and of course, Dag Hammarskjöld wasn't just killed by this far-right group. The implication is that CIA and MI6 were deeply involved in all of this, because don't forget that they'd arranged the murder of Patrice Lumumba, who was the democratically elected president of the Congo, and that Dag Hammarskjöld was down there trying to sort out the ensuing battles over Katanga.
Without going into too much detail, it's pretty clear that it was Western corporations were financing much of this. Their mining interests were threatened by the new colonial leaders.
And they work hand in glove with intelligence agencies.
Well, the CIA and MI6 seem to have been facilitators.
Well, that's right. I mean, they're all the same team. And don't forget, when CIA and MI6 people retire, they go and work for these private companies, which they're also helping out when they're in their official jobs paid for by our taxes.
Well, one of the most disturbing bits of the documentary is where we hear about the AIDS being deliberately injected into black Africans to kill the black population by this SIMAR group. And there was a particular biologist, a young biologist recruited by them to do this work, that then tried to blow the whistle to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Would the South African government, the apartheid regime, would they have known that SIMAR was spreading AIDS inside South Africa and outside as well to kill off black people?
Highly likely. That's why I'm telling you that's why people were killed for it.
That's why Dagmar Feld was killed, maybe.
Yeah. That's why Dagmar was killed.
You're wasting the ship's time!
And after the death of Dagmar, Dagmar's mother continues to investigate the case. She wants to find out who killed her daughter. She tried to give witness about the event to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Okay.
They told her no, because it was too controversial.
Yeah.
The murders were never found. The case was not investigated.
And they would not listen to her. In fact, I think the second or third time that she went to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they escorted her out.
She was asked to leave.
Yeah, they would not debate this issue at all. She said, her words to me were to the effect that just the mention of the South African Maritime Institute made people nervous. They would not listen at all.
Then she befriends a SIMA lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
or a SIMA officer, I believe maybe it's Maxwell, who feeds her information about SIMA and her daughter.
Yes.
He approached my mom. I don't know whether it was out of guilt or whether just a prick of his conscience. He contacted my mother and gave her a whole lot of documents. I believe they met several times. And in there are letterheads of the South African Maritime Institute. So this was the first time that I had ever heard of that institute. She was given a telephone number, a Johannesburg telephone number to phone.
Yes.
And I vaguely recall my mom saying, this gentleman said, if you phone this number, you'll find out what you need to know.
You want Julian over the Thompson?
Yes, please.
Hold on. I'll try and get him for you.
Thank you. She phones that number, and suddenly Julian Ogilvie Thompson is on the line.
Hello?
Back then, the CEO of the giant mining corporation, Anglo-American.
He allowed her to speak. He allowed her to state why she was phoning, how she'd got the number, and she wanted to know more about what had happened to her daughter. And he gave her a veiled threat on the telephone.
I mean, I have no recollection of any of these things.
No?
No.
Do you remember speaking to the mother of Dagmar Fayle? Maybe she called you?
No, I don't.
Interesting.
Why should she call me?
He said that he knew about me. He knew about my brother, my stepbrother. He knew where both of us lived, and that if she ever phoned the number again, there would be serious consequences.
Ogilvie Thompson told her that?
Yes.
Look, I'm afraid I have no recollection of either somebody being murdered or being telephoned by his mother.
Not long after, we go to an address in Johannesburg, where the personal belongings of Dagmar's mother are stored. She's dead now, Dagmar's mother. And in her belongings, we find an address book. There we have him. Julian Ogilvie Thompson.
We have him there. Yes.
Anglo.
Uh-oh.
So, interesting, phoning the boss of Anglo-American Mining Company, Martin, and he says he knows nothing about it.
Well, in the famous words of Mandy Rice Davies, he would say that, wouldn't he?
Well, I was very pleased to be able to speak to the producer of that documentary from Sweden, Andreas Roxson, earlier this week. And he had this to say about those. I was particularly interested in the sort of the motivation behind all this, the mining companies, the resources, that sort of thing. And, of course, CIA and MI6.
There are a few things that points towards mining companies. And when it comes to Susan Williams' research, she is going into the old structures called the Monday Club. That was a very right-wing Tory organization or club for Tory MPs. And some of these MPs, Charles Waterstone, Patrick Wall, and Sir Lord Selborne, were very, they had very big interests in the mining companies in Southern Africa and also in real estate in Southern Africa. Charles Waterstone and Lord Selborne were on the boards of many of the the big companies, Union Minière, Tank, Rhodesian Selection Trust.
Okay, so
the giants down there.
Okay, so we're hearing about France and Britain, really, but not the CIA, not the United States.
That is not the impression that Alexander Jones has. And the only connection we have is in the documents that were presented by Desmond Tutu in 1998. In one of the documents, it says that Alan Dulles is giving a green light for the operation or to kill Dag Hammarskjöld. So that would be the only connection, a close connection to Symer that we can see. CIA, I think that if you have an organization, a clandestine military organization working from the base having a base in South Africa, that would be in the know of any of the big agencies, and then that they would have a blind eye to what they did, or they are informed but not objective.
That's Andreas Roxon. The full interview is on Dialect next Tuesday at noon. But this is a pretty murky world here, Martin. Two main stories, the murder of the UN Secretary General and then injecting black people with AIDS. That's Symar's little role.
Well, I mean, it all sounds absolutely plausible to me, and you've got to remember that these were very desperate and very nasty people, and they still are.
Difficult to find to actually watch this online or anything, though, but I'm not sure how people can do that. What I can do is I'll put up some longer clips on our podcast off of the documentary, so you can shut your eyes and imagine the documentary, because I think that's pretty much all we can do. The BBC did have it on their iPlayer, but they took it off. Maybe you could write to the BBC, email them or phone them up and say, put this documentary back on your iPlayer, please, because we paid for it with our license fee, partly. It's a Danish film and a Danish filmmaker, but certainly well worth watching that. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8 o'clock. Coming up live on Facebook should be Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, former Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks to him too. You'll find the podcast, story links, etc. at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon. I'll be back in April, God willing. Do please join us on the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.